Good morning, people of God. It's good to see each and every one of you this morning. If you have your Bibles, turn with me to Psalm 36. Psalm 36. And I'd like to read this morning from verses 5 through 9. Psalm 36, and I'll be reading from the New International Version. Psalm 36, beginning with verse 5. Your love, O Lord, reaches to the heavens. Your faithfulness to the skies. Your righteousness is like the mighty mountains. Your justice like the great deep. O Lord, you preserve both man and beast. How priceless is your unfailing love. You might want to underline that in your Bible. How priceless is your unfailing love. Both high and low among men find refuge in the shadow of your wings. They feast on the abundance of your house. You give them drink from your river of delights. For with you is the fountain of life. In your light, we see light. In your light, we see light. Let me begin this morning with a little Irish prayer that goes like this. May those who love us, and those that don't love us, may God turn their hearts. And if he doesn't turn their hearts, may he turn their ankles. So we will know them by their limping. You're probably wondering, who's this young, handsome, intelligent, humble person that's going to speak to you this morning? I was born sometime in 1951. 1952 or 1953. Now, ladies, that's what's called long labor. I have no idea when I was born. I was a war child from the streets of Korea. My mother was an alcoholic and a prostitute. The 7 years I lived with my mother, I cannot remember her being sober one day. I grew up in a little village called Myadi Myong Dong. How many of you know where that's at? Some of you, yes. If you know Korea, you know Northern Korea, which is Communist Korea, then the DMZ divides North from South Korea, and South Korea is Democratic Korea. If you go about 60 miles south of DMZ, you'll come to a large city by the name of Seoul, Korea, which is the capital of South Korea. In the 1950s, if you go about 10 miles north of Seoul, Korea, on a little hill, there was a little village called Myadi in the province of Myeongdong, Myadi Myeongdong. And at the base of the hill, there was a United Nations Marine base. Our village consisted of women and children, if you get the picture. I remember many nights going to my home. When I say home, I'm talking about a little shack on the side of a hill. And I could hear the laughter of my mother and the Marine or Marines, but I was not welcome in my own home. During the spring and summer evenings, the children of the village, we would play late into the night. And then we'd find a bush or a tree, and we'd huddle together, and that's where we would sleep. And then the next morning, we'd go to our respective homes. But that part of Korea would get so cold during the wintertime that the rice paddies would freeze over. And on those cold winter nights that we had no place to go, we would go out to the rice paddies because the Marines who patrolled the rice paddies had taken 50-gallon barrels, put them on the corners of the rice paddies, filled them with oil, and they would light those barrels so while they patrolled at night, they'd have a place to warm themselves. So we would go out to the rice paddies, and we would huddle around those barrels, and that's where we would sleep on those cold winter nights. But some Marines, and having been in the Marine Corps myself from 1970 to 1974, I understand why some Marines would not let the children sleep around those barrels. Because when you're patrolling at night and you're approaching a glowing barrel, you have no idea who's sitting or lying around those barrels. So some Marines, for their own safety, would not let the children sleep around those barrels. And on those nights that we were not allowed to sleep on those barrels, around those barrels, we'd get up and we start walking back toward our village. But as we walk toward our village, every time we came to a large trash container, those dumpsters about 6 feet long, about 4 feet wide, about so high, we would stop and we would look inside those trash containers. And when we found one that was full of garbage, we would crawl into that trash container, push the garbage to the side, huddle together, pull the garbage around us. And that's where we would sleep on those cold winter nights, along with the rats that infested those trash containers. And I remember times climbing in those trash containers and find the cold, still body of children who had not survived the night or the nights before. When I was about 6 years of age, my mother said to me, "In-soo," that's my Korean name, Park In-soo. And she gave me a little pouch. And she said, "If you fill this pouch up with tobacco, I will give you something to eat." And I was so excited, because that's the first time I ever remember my mother saying that she would give me something to eat. I took the little pouch and I ran down to the Marine station and I followed the Marines who smoked the cigarettes. And when they throw their cigarette butts on the ground, I'd run over and I'd pick up those cigarette butts. And I loved to follow the Marines who smoked the non-filter cigarettes, because I could always get more tobacco from their cigarette butts than the ones who smoked the filter cigarettes. And sometimes I would take the paper on those cigarette butts and I'd tear the paper into tiny, tiny, tiny little pieces and put it in that pouch, hoping that my mother in a drunken state would not realize I had mixed the tobacco and the paper together. In November of 1958, I woke up one morning in an alleyway. And I said to myself, there's got to be more to life than this. And that morning, instead of staying in the village, I started walking. And to this day, I don't know why I started walking south. I could have walked north. I could have walked east or west. But that morning when I started walking south. And by that evening, it was getting cold. I had to find shelter. But in front of me, I saw the lights of Seoul, Korea. And when I got to northern Seoul, Korea, I found a little train station, and that became my home for the next 3 days, because it provided shelter from the cold, and it also provided food. The way it provided food was, most of the people who traveled on trains in those days would be traveling and be gone all day, so they would carry their food with them. I'd look at that crowd and find someone who wasn't paying that close attention to their sack of food. And I'd run as fast as I could, and I'd grab their sack of food, and while I was still running, I'd reach in, I'd grab a handful of food, and then I'd drop the sack of food, and I'd keep on running with my fistful of food, and the person that was chasing me would stop chasing me to gather their food, and I would escape into the crowd. Oh, life was great for 3 days. But on the third day, I was running as fast as I could with a fistful of food, when I ran smack into a police officer. He picked me up and he put me on a bench up against the wall and he said, "You sit right there." I sat there for probably about an hour. And then this woman came and she sat next to me and she put her arms around me and gave me a big old hug. And she gave me a piece of candy. And I sat there. And I ate that piece of candy. And after I finished eating the candy, the police officer looked at me and said, "Do you want to go with her or do you want to go with me?" I wasn't stupid. I said, "I'll go with her." And she took me to the Holt Orphanage there in Seoul, Korea. When I got to the Holt Orphanage, the doctor looked at my teeth and gave me a birth year. He said, "I think you were born in 1952. And then they gave me a calendar, and I got to pick out the month and the date, and that became my birthday. I got to pick out my own birthday. Now, one of the things made us do at the orphanage that I thought was a waste of time, every morning and every night, we had to brush our teeth. I had never brushed my teeth until I went to the orphanage. There's a picture of me sitting on the edge of the bed at the orphanage, and I'm grinning from ear to ear, and every tooth in my mouth is black, because I never brushed my teeth. One evening, I'm brushing my teeth, and I'm saying to myself, this is really stupid. This is a waste of time. These suckers are never going to turn white. I can't believe they're making me do this. But as I was brushing my teeth, I went, you know, this Crest tastes pretty good. And it really does. It really does. So I took the tube of toothpaste, stuck it in my pants, went to bed that night, and when they turned the lights off, I got that tube of toothpaste out, and I ate all the toothpaste that was in that tube to help the hunger pains that I felt in my stomach. It wasn't too long after that, the children in the orphanage were so excited. They said, Abuji is coming today. Now, Abuji in the Korean language means father. It meant nothing to me. Never had a father. But then they said, when Abuji comes, talking about Harry Holt, the founder of the orphanage, when he comes, he always brings us presents. Oh, I got excited. No one had ever given me a present in my life. And I could not wait until this person came so that I could have a present. It's the noon meal, and I'm sitting in front of my bowl of rice soup. And I know it's rice soup because we had rice soup for breakfast, rice soup for lunch, and rice soup for supper. I'm sitting in front of my bowl of rice soup when the double doors to the kitchen opened up, and this man walked through those doors who not only had red hair on his head, but he had red hair all over his face. I did not know that human beings could have so much hair on their face. I mean, the Papa Sons had this little squeaky thing that came down like this. The Marines had a little mustache, but his whole face was covered with red hair. And underneath his arms, he had these two big old bags. He untied the bags, dumped out the contents, and balls of every size and color started bouncing on that cement floor. And I, like the rest of the kids who could walk, we forgot about our bowl of rice soup. And we jumped up and we ran and we just dove right in the middle of all those balls. Because they said, whatever he brings and you get a hold of, that's yours to keep. I tried to get two or three balls in my hands and arms. But finally, I was able to get a hold of one ball that no one else was able to take away from me. And holding on to that ball, I went and I sat in front of my bowl of rice soup. At the orphanage, they taught us that before we ate, we always bowed our head and we closed our eyes and a blessing was given for the food. You know, I thought back all these years, why did I not bow my head and close my eyes that day? Maybe it's because this man had so much hair on his face. Maybe it's because he'd give me a present. I don't know, but I do remember this. I saw something that day that I had never seen in my life. I saw a grown man cry. I had never seen that before. As Harry Holt prayed that day, he not only prayed for the food, but he prayed that God would provide loving mothers and fathers, caring homes. And as he prayed that prayer, the tears came streaming down his cheeks. And I sat there 7 years of age, watching this man as he prayed and as he wept. And after he finished praying, I said out loud, Abuji, Abuji. I called him father. For the first time in my life, 7 years of age, I felt within my heart that someone really cared about me. I'd never had that feeling before. I feel very fortunate because only 6 months in the orphanage, I was on a plane coming to the United States. Most people want to adopt children who are 7 or 8 months old, not 7 or 8 years old, who've grown up their whole life on the street, but I was on that plane, we had 6 women taking care of all those babies and children. Most of them are diaper babies. I was the oldest child on that plane. When that plane landed in Hawaii and they opened those doors, those 6 women went screaming off that plane. They'd had enough. They brought a crew in and cleaned the mess the best they could. And then they shoved those 6 women back on the plane, locked the doors, and we flew to Portland, Oregon. When we got to Portland, Oregon, one of the ladies took me by the hand She walked me halfway down the steps and she stopped and she said, "Insu, this is your new Abuji. His name was Roy Webb. He was a school administrator from the state of Oklahoma. And there's three things that I remember about Roy Webb. What? He had no hair." I thought, how can he be my father? We might be short, but we have hair. The second thing that I remember about Roy Webb, he was a big man because he stood over 6 foot tall and weighed about 235 pounds. And the third thing that I remember about Roy Webb, he had lots of money. And the reason I knew that, he stood there, he had a suit and a tie on. And when he saw me standing there, the first thing he did was he took me to the restaurant there at the airport because 7 or 8 years of age, 6 months in the orphanage, I weighed all of 39 pounds. He took me to the restaurant and he tried to say, "Tommy, order whatever you want to. Buy whatever food that you want. I'll buy you whatever food you want. What do you want?" Well, he knew no Korean. The only English words I knew is cowboys and Indians. And Jesus loves me. You know, it's pretty hard to carry on a conversation when that's all the English. Well, I did know some other English words. Huh. You guys are ahead of me, aren't you? But they told me at the orphanage, "Don't you dare say those words, or you're going to be in big time trouble." Those are words I learned from the Marines. So here my dad and I are sitting around this table trying to communicate, not doing very well, when all of a sudden a waitress goes past our table with a platter full of hamburgers and french fries that someone else in the restaurant had ordered. When I smelled those hamburger and french fries, oh, they smelled so good. My stomach just did a flip-flop. And without thinking, I pointed at the platter. When I pointed at the platter, the waitress stopped, took a plate with hamburger and french fries on it, and put it in front of me for me to eat. And I said to myself, I love this country. All you got to do is point and they bring the food to you. This is wonderful. So I'm eating my hamburger french fries. Waitress go past us with food that someone else ordered. I point. She put another plate in front of me. I point. She put. Dad said I had 4 or 5 plates in front of me. And I ate and I ate and I ate until I could not eat another bite. I mean, I was so stuffed. My little stomach was just sticking way out there. And it's still sticking out there. And then I did something that embarrassed my father so much. When I could not eat another bite of food, I stood up and I grabbed a handful of french fries and I started stuffing them into my pockets. Because the number one rule of survival on the streets is, if you don't eat your food, you take the food with you. You never leave food behind. When my father saw me stuffing those greasy french fries into my pockets, he was so embarrassed. He started shoving all the plates away from me. Did not slow me down one bit. I dove across the table, grabbed another handful of french fries. By this time, the waitresses who'd been watching this little boy consume all of this food came running over, and they had these bags. And they started putting food into these bags, and I'm watching them, and all of a sudden I realize, this is how they carry their extra food in this country. Not in their pockets, but in these bags. And one of the ladies filled a bag about halfway full. She put it on the edge of the table. And then she got another doggy bag. And she was helping fill that doggy bag up with food. And when she scooted away from the bag that she had put on the edge of the table, I walked over there and got the greasy french fries out of my pockets. And I put them into that bag. Stuffed them in there. And then I picked the bag up and I held it up against my chest, trying to hide that bag with my arms, hoping that I'd be able to keep that bag of food for myself. Dad said there must have been 7 or 8 of those doggy bags stuffed full of food. And when they got finished filling all those doggy bags, my father tried to explain to me, "Tommy, all of this food is yours. All these bags of food, it's your food." And he said, I just looked at him while he was trying to explain it. All of a sudden, a big old smile came across my face. And he said, I knew that he understood what I was trying to tell him. And he said, after I had a big old smile come across my face, he said, I walked over to the edge of that table where all those sacks were. And he said, I bent over and I just put my little arms around all those bags of food and I crushed them up against my chest. And he said, I had a tough time walking with all that food in my arms, but I would not let him carry one bag of that food because that was my food. When we got into the taxi cab, I was sitting in the back seat, and we got to the motel room. He said he opened up the back seat, and he tried to reach in and help me out of the back seat. I thought he was trying to take food away from me, so I started scooting across the table or across the back seat of the taxi cab. Finally, Dad said he just had to get out of the way, and pretty soon I scooted across, and I followed him to our motel room. When we got to the motel room, Dad said he opened up the door to the motel room. He said, I took a step forward, and then I stopped. He said, I looked around that motel room. I'd never been in a motel room in my life. I looked around, and then he said, I slowly carried all that food over to the edge of the bed in the corner, put all the sacks of food up against the corner, and then I took my jacket off and I covered the food the best that I could cover, trying to hide that food, not knowing just Dad and I would be in that room that night. That evening, my father gave me a banana. I had never eaten a banana in my life. I ate the banana. And then I looked at the peeling, and I put the peeling in my mouth, and I started chewing on the banana peeling. Don't do that. Don't do that. I said, of all the foods I've eaten in this country, this is the worst. This is terrible. But it's food, and I'm not going to throw it away, so I'm chewing on this banana. When my father sees me chewing on that banana peeling, he comes running over. He tries to take the banana peeling out of my mouth. The only thing I can think is trying to take food away from me, so I start stuffing it further into my mouth. So there in this motel room, we just had a little tug of war over this little banana peeling. Now imagine my dad weighing 235 pounds. I weigh probably about 43 pounds by now. He just picked me up by one hand, took me over to the dresser, gave me another banana for me to eat the banana. I had to take the peeling out. When I took the peeling out, Dad grabbed that peeling, threw it into the wastebasket, and that's how I learned not to eat the peeling of the banana. The next morning, we flew from Portland, Oregon to Tulsa, Oklahoma, and there I met my mother, Ruth Webb, for the very first time. A very unique woman. When she was happy, she was crying. When she was sad, she was crying. I remember her charging across that airport field and coming to me, and she's yelling, Tommy, Tommy. And she gets to me, and she picks me up, and she's hugging me, and she's kissing me, and she's just boo-hooing away. She's looking at my hands, making sure all my little fingers are all there. We get home, and she puts me in the bathtub, and she's washing me, and she's just boo-hooing, and she's praying away. She puts the wash rag down. And through her tears, she starts counting my ribs, which are protruding out. And she prays this prayer. Lord, put some meat on these bones. I've had the privilege of playing two state championship football teams, playing a Marine Corps football team for 2 years. And during that time, I consumed a lot of food, but I was very active. When I got out of the Marine Corps, I still consumed a lot of food, but I wasn't very active. About 40 years ago, I went home for Christmas there in Junction City, Kansas. And my mother was fixing Christmas dinner in the kitchen, and I sort of waddled in there. I said, Mother, do you remember that prayer you prayed when I first came over? She said, yes, I do. And I said, you can stop praying that prayer. It's been answered sufficiently. Oh, I wish I had more time to share with you. At the age of 66, I understand the person that I am today is because of the choices that I have made. I understand that. But I also understand if it had not been for certain people who reached out with a hand of compassion and caring to help me in the journey of life. Reality is, I would not even be alive today. I am so thankful for Roy and Ruth Webb, who had two children already, and yet they chose to open their hearts and their lives for a seven-year-old street child. I am thankful for Harry Holt, who was a successful farmer in Eugene, Oregon. But when he heard a missionary speak about the children dying in the streets in post-war Korea, he said for the next 2 weeks, every time he got on that tractor, God was speaking to him, and he had all the excuses why he could not do what God was asking him to do. But he said after 2 weeks of struggling with that, one day he came in for lunch and he said to his wife, Bertha, this is what God's been speaking to me about. And Bertha said, oh, Harry, he's been speaking to me and I've been praying that you'd say something. And so Harry Holt flew over to Korea, and when he saw the children dying in post-war Korea with his own eyes, he came back and he and Bertha had a special bill passed in Congress that allowed them to adopt more children than what the laws allowed at that time. And then after they'd done that, he went back to Seoul, Korea, and started the Holt Orphanage, which has touched the hearts and lives of millions of people throughout the world. I am so thankful that there are those people who are willing to listen and obey and allow their light to shine within a darker world and truly make a positive difference in the lives that they touch. There's a little song that I learned as a child. It goes like this. This little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. Let it shine. Let it shine. Let it shine. Hide it under a bushel. No, I'm going to let it shine. Hide it under a bushel. No, I'm going to let it shine. Let it shine. Let it shine. Let it shine. John Maxwell said, your candle loses nothing when it lights another. Let me ask you this morning, are you allowing his light to shine through your life, within your family, within your community, within your church? And I know at times when we allow our lights to shine, it's going to cost us something. I remember the story of a surgeon who was called by God to go and minister to a tribe deep in the forest of Africa. And he struggled with that call. One day he said yes, and he went there. And he'd been there for a few months when one of his friends decided, I'm going to go and visit him. And he went to, his friend came to Africa and went, traveled to this little village way in the forest. And there his friend was practicing, helping those people in a little hut without an air conditioning, flies everywhere, the stench. And when he walked in to see his friend was working on a man who'd been brought to that village that had injured his arm and gangrene had set in, and the doctor was unwrapping that wound, and the maggots and the stench of the smell of death flesh, dying flesh. And the friend that came to visit his doctor friend was nauseated by the smell and the sight, and he had stepped outside. And while he was outside, his doctor friend came out to visit him. The visitor said to the doctor, what are you doing here? I wouldn't be doing this for $1 million. And the doctor looked at his friend and said, neither would I. Neither would I. Jesus said, I've come to serve, not to be served. And if that's God's purpose or Jesus' purpose here on earth, then maybe our purpose should be to serve those around us. And when we choose to serve, our light will truly shine. This morning, I want you just to bow your head and close your eyes. And I want you to think about this question. This little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. What does that mean for you in the journey of life? What has God challenged you in the journey of life? And my challenge to you this morning is listen and obey. This little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. Let it shine, let it shine. Let it shine. It goes like this, and I want you to join with me. This little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. Let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. Hide it under a bushel. No. I'm going to let it shine. Hide it under a bushel. No, I'm going to let it shine. Let it shine. Let it shine. Let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. Let it shine. Let it shine. Let it shine. That is my challenge to you today as you leave this place of worship. How priceless is your unfailing love. For with you is the fountain of life. In your light, we see light. Thank you and may God bless each and every one of you.